Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Alison, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
You're having a slightly less exciting day today than you did last Sunday. What were you doing last Sunday?
I was actually dropping my dad into town to collect his car. I was doing a good deed and driving down the road, I seen a man and he was just standing looking a bit concerned. So when I was driving up, I took out the old phone and took a video and there was a snake.
A snake?
A snake coming out from under a fence, yeah.
And you could see what, the head poking out or the body slithering out at this stage?
The body, nearly most of the body, yeah.
And when you say the man was looking concerned, was he backing away from it or just kind of with the jaw dropped having a look at it?
Yeah, kind of, is this happening kind of a phase? Am I dreaming?
Right. And describe the snake to us.
He was very, like, white. This white, long thing I saw. I was like, oh, God, because I hate snakes. Like, so I was, like, not getting out of the car. So what I'd done was I actually dropped my dad down the road, 2 minutes down the road, and I felt bad. So I turned around and I drove back up. And then the snake actually got into the middle of the road, so I stopped my car in case. So it's a busy road, so the cars were flying up and down, so I just stopped and held up the traffic and helped another man. I didn't get his name, unfortunately, to get it into a bag, like a reusable gun stores bag, and he brought it down then to Sunbeam Fest.
Hang on a second now. You're frightened of snakes, are you? You don't... Don't like
oh,
them
no,
at all.
I hate that. No,
wouldn't go into the snake house in the zoo, no?
Oh, God, no.
Right.
Not at all.
So, anyway, you got worried about the snake, despite the fact that you're not mad about snakes.
Yeah, I kind of felt it must have escaped that with someone's pet, and I have a dog myself, so I would hope someone would do the same for me to try to save an animal or that kind of a way. So I said, a good karma, and I just turned around and I had the old snake.
Right, so he was getting out from underneath the fence, or it was getting out from underneath the fence by
yeah.
the time you're going down the road with your dad, you're coming back up and now it's in the middle of the road. So you park your car to protect the snake and then,
yeah.
despite your morbid fear, you get out of the car.
I did, yeah. And I goes, I think I might have a bag in the back. If you're happy to find a stick, I'll hold the bag open and we can try to get the snake in together.
And was this fella standing by the side of the road looking at the snake coming across?
Yeah, he was, yeah.
And did he go and get, you know, the way you see on the television, is it a forked stick you need to pick up a snake or is it any
old
stick?
No, he literally just got a stick from the side of the road that fell off a tree, like, if you saw the two of us.
And what were you holding the bag and he was doing the stick? What was your job in all of this?
Yeah, I was holding the bag, trying to kind of scoop the snake into it while he was lifting the kind of snake up with a stick.
And was it wriggling around now on the end of the stick?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it definitely
Tail
was.
Tail thrashing.
Yeah.
Any hissing out of it?
No, not that I heard. I was just like, get the snake into the bag.
And were you worried it would touch you?
Oh, yeah. Terrified. I think when I got back into the car, once the snake was okay, I realised what I've done and I was like, oh my God, how did I do that?
So hang on a second. This guy helps you get the snake into the bag that you'd got out of the car and now you take this bag into your car, do you?
No, I was too afraid. So the other man took the snake in the bag and he brought it down to the vets in Blackpool.
Right, so he just closed over the top of the bag and then got it down. How far
yeah.
How far away was the vet? How far did he have to carry this snake?
It would be about a 5 or 10 minute drive.
And so he went down in his car, did he?
Yeah, right. Definitely. Something I couldn't do now.
So you didn't go out of curiosity and see what happened to the snake, did you?
No, I was worried about the snake, so I just did a little bit on social media and found out that the vets had it up on social media. So I was happy knowing that the snake was back home.
The snake was safe, right? Roxy Stakelam, good afternoon to you.
Afternoon.
So Alison stopped in the car to protect the snake in the middle of the road. It was a good move.
Yeah, I'm holding the snake right now, actually.
So can you tell us, is the snake a boy or a girl? What type of a snake is it?
She's an albino cairn snake, and she's a girl.
Right. And where did she come from? She's your snake, isn't she?
She's my snake, yeah.
And how long have you had her?
Maybe 3-4 years around.
Right. Yeah. And what made you want to have a snake?
Oh, they're cool. They look huge. They look funny. They're like non-slimy big worms.
Right. And how, do you remember first asking your parents, could you have a snake? How did that come about?
Well, I don't know, man. I was 3.
You've been begging them for then what? You got it when you were about 8 and you were begging them for 5 solid years to get a snake.
No, I got a snake and then we always knew the snake, so I didn't need... We were both new to snakes, so it wasn't really that good. I wasn't that good at taking care of it, because it was, but I wasn't good at keeping a good containment for it, right?
Right.
So it escaped, right? And after that, I was obviously sad, but I got a new snake then, and this is the new snake now.
And was the other snake the same type? Was it an albino corn snake as well?
No, it was a corn snake, but it wasn't albino. It was just a regular one.
Right. And when you say the first one got out, I mean, what was it being kept in?
It was being kept in a cage, but then the lid broke or something. Sorry. Do you want to go back into her thing? Yeah, so I'm just going to put her back. They were in a glass box thing, right?
Right.
You know, like an old fish tank type thing. But the lid broke or it wasn't good or something like that, I can't remember. But anyway, I think the lid broke, and my mom thought with horses, right? You know the way with horses you can put a blanket over a wire and the horse would see it as a wall. My mom thought it might work the same with snakes, but it didn't. And she just kind of realised it was a blanket and kind of just left. We haven't found her since.
So the first snake anyway escaped. And where were you when you heard the second one was gone?
On my way back from a campsite, from a camp thing called Earthlong.
So who rang you or who rang your family to tell you?
My oma. My grandma, basically, she rang me, and her friend saw people looking at the snake and filming the snake and doing stuff like that with the snake and was wait a minute, my doesn't my friend's daughter have a kid who has a snake and rung my oma and was like. You don't have a snake by any chance, do you? A white one? And she's oh no, I think we do. And she rang us and gave us the news, and we were yeah, you know?
Right. So you knew the snake was missing. Anyway, Rebecca, your mother's on the line as well. Rebecca, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
We were just talking to Roxy there, your 13-year-old son. And this snake escape wasn't your first rodeo, so... tell us how you heard about this second escape and what your reaction was when you heard it.
I actually stopped breathing. I heard my mother on the phone saying, there's a snake crossing the road outside your house.
Right. How far were you from home now at this stage when you got that phone call?
We were half an hour away from home and we'd been gone for 9 days and my brother was minding all the animals. And I stopped breathing. I went, oh no. Oh my goodness. So I knew she was probably okay because there was people watching her. If people had not stopped to watch her or hadn't seen her.
The snake's name is Pooka.
Pooka.
Because
Pooka
it's white.
The snake.
Like a ghost.
She is.
Yeah.
She's white like a ghost. She's actually a caramel albino and she is a meter long or so. Now,
okay,
and we got her actually 4 years ago at Christmas. So, She is an escape artist, but she's never gone outside the house before.
Oh, she's escaped inside in the house. Has
she likes, she loves to be out. She loves it. She will, we'll take her out and she will actually go around the sitting room and go on top of the piano and on top of the bookshelf and behind the TV.
Would she rattle a tune out of the piano when she's sliding
across
it? She'll
rattle a tune out of the piano. She's a great piano player. And, so she we do actually allow her out in the sitting room.
Right. And I mean, did you always like snakes, Rebecca?
I never had any experience with snakes, to be quite honest. Do I like snakes? They're actually, when you get to know them, they're actually lovely animals. They're lovely creatures.
You sound like you're a bit of a convert to snake
ownership. I'm a convert.
You are.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I love animals. We love animals in our house.
And it was Roxy that convinced you there, was it, to get the snake?
Roxy convinced me. We had our first snake many years ago, and Roxy was quite small when we had that snake. And when she escaped, because the lid broke, it wasn't that I thought the snake was like a horse, but the lid broke, and I underestimated the size of the hole that she was going to be able to get out of. And she escaped, and we were all heartbroken for so long that it took a long time before we got another snake. But we do think that snake made it down to the train station and was spotted. There was a video.
Did it have a pre-booked ticket?
It had a pre-booked ticket. It was going to Dublin Zoo and our photo. Not sure where it was going, but it went on the way. And if you were to go through the gardens from our house, all the way you could make it to the train station.
All right, okay. And come here, Roxy, what does the snake eat? What does Pooka eat?
She eats dead, unfrosted mice and other things, a bit marvelous, but you know, you got to eat when you got to eat.
Right. You buy a big bag of frozen dead mice and you pop them in the freezer and kind of defrost them in batches, is it?
Yeah, she gets like one a week because that's what we were recommended to by the people that you've gone on. Oh, not
on her,
the people that were
standing there. Right. So one a week, that's pretty a pretty reasonable pet to feed, isn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, Rebecca, you hear the pet is gone, you're half an hour from home, you're coming back from the campsite, you land back to the house. Is there a commotion on the street outside at this stage, or has it all calmed down, and has anyone told you where the snake has gone to? Sure, talk us through what happened when you hit the house.
No, so I really held my breath on the way home. The car was full of camping gear. We were gone for 9 days. I parked the car, I jumped out. All I knew was that the snake had crossed the road. So I went into my neighbour's gardens, who didn't appear to be there, and I started going through their gardens and looking under all their bushes. So I probably looked like a right weirdo.
Right. They probably came out and asked you what you were looking for, did they?
They didn't, actually. Right. So I don't know if they were there or if they were just looking out, wondering what I was doing, or they weren't there. But I just thought I better just look, because if she was to be found, it was going to have to be soon. So I got into all the neighbours' gardens, looked around all their gardens, and called some neighbours. And just as I was finished that and I was thinking, oh no, this could be bad, I got a message from my friend who happened to know we had a snake, from a Facebook post to say, a snake had been found on Ballyhooly Road.
Right. You're still holding your breath at this age. I don't know what colour you are.
I am still holding my breath.
A purple-faced woman going around searching the neighbour's garden. Did you release your breath at that stage? What shade of purple had you hit?
I did. I actually, like, it really was. It was kind of, it was because if she was gone, she was gone. I mean, a snake is a hard thing to find. It's hard to find a snake in a sitting room. I will tell you that. It's hard to find a snake. They can curl up so small that, you know, they make no noise. They're so quiet. If they don't want to be found, you're not going to find it.
Right. And was Roxy out helping you look for this snake?
I actually did it myself.
Right.
Because I didn't know what the outcome was going to be.
Oh, right.
And so I just thought, I'm just going to go look for that snake.
Right. And what were you doing, Roxy, now, while your mother was out looking for the snake? He's gone. He's pleading the fifth on that one. Anyway, do you know what he was doing while you were looking for the snake, Rebecca?
I'm not sure. But
You were protecting him from the worst possible consequence.
I actually thought there's no point in bringing other people with me for this.
Okay. So anyway, Sunbeam Vets had posted on social media. Somebody alerted you to this post. And how is Pooka, I suppose we should ask?
She is great. We went up and they had said she was very feisty when they got her. They were like, is she normally that feisty? She was hissing and showing teeth and really showing off. But when they brought her down, she arched up her back and she just let me pick her up. And she was totally calm, totally happy, knew who I was and got into the box.
What does arching up her back signify? As in, pick me up, get me out of here?
She let me pick her up. She just let me pick her up, happy out, without any problems. And
How do you know if a snake is happy? I mean, you said hissing and showing teeth is a sign
they're unhappy. If they're unhappy, they can rattle their tail and it will make a noise. It's not like a rattlesnake, but it will make a noise. They will open their mouth and show their teeth and they will wiggle to try and get away from you, and they'll move very, very quickly.
Okay. And a happy snake, what does that do?
And a happy snake will just go very slowly, mouth closed, just you'll know, like, she's very calm.
Okay.
They'll happily go around your arm. They'll just stay with you. They'll happily touch, you know, off your skin, no problem.
Right. I suppose there's every chance that Pooka was missing all her other animal friends in the house. And there's quite a few of them. Roxy, is Roxy still there? Do you have a few? You have a few other animals. Do you want to talk us through the animal head count in the house?
We have a dog. We have two cats, and we have an axolotl.
An axolotl.
Yeah.
And does the axolotl it's an amphibian? For anyone who doesn't know what an axolotl is, for people whose kids play Minecraft, they might have seen the digital version of the axolotl. But does the axolotl have a kind of a water tank and a dry land area there as well?
She's completely aquatic. Right. They can't survive out of water. Like, they can, but obviously not for long. Like, it's like a dolphin, you know.
Right. So she won't be escaping anyway. That's looked after. What's her name?
She's Mango. I call her Mango because when I got her, I was planning on naming them Chocolate and Mango. There used to be another one, but he sadly got sick and passed away. I was going to name them that because I thought they would look like ice cream, like the ice cream mango flavor.
Gotcha.
I was originally going to call her Lemon, but she didn't look like a lemon flavor. She looked like the mango flavor. So I named her Mango instead.
And come here, the snake, Roxy, is it a cuddly kind of a pet? Do you take it out and handle it regularly? Is that what's recommended when you're looking after a snake?
Yeah, it's what's recommended. Sometimes I forget, and I do feel guilty when I forget. But when I do it, she's relatively calm. Unless she's tired and wants to be left alone, then she's like wriggling around the place, wants to go back to sleep.
Right, and does she sleep a lot of the time, or what does she do when she's active?
No, what's she doing? She's active or roam around.
Right. Would you recommend them as pets? I asked this because somebody, a 12-year-old in my own house, was looking for a snake recently and was asking me for them. What do you think? What's the verdict? Would you recommend them?
What I would recommend for snakes, right, is get a snake if you're ready to be dedicated to it and you're ready for it to possibly escape. That's my opinion.
Right. And Kamir, have you anything to say to Alison, the woman who stopped the car? Have you had a chance to talk to her before, or do you want to have a word with her? She's still on the line.
I haven't talked to her at all.
Okay. Well, do you want to say anything to her? She's on the line. She's the woman who helped get the snake in the bag, and herself and the man who so far remains anonymous and nameless. If he's out there, he can give us a shout. Do you want to say anything to Alison for helping rescue Pooka?
You're class, and I'm glad you did that, and good karma will come your way.
Very good.
Thank you.
Rebecca?
Alison, you absolutely did us such a favour by being so brave and actually getting out of the car and doing that, because if you didn't, we would probably have never seen her again.
Right.
So thank you so much, because a lot of people would be too scared. They'd run away. They wouldn't. They would just say, oh my God, there's a snake. I'm leaving. So thank you. That was really great. Really amazing.
Roxy, one more question. Would you call your next snake Alison?
Maybe. I do have one more thing to say, though. My friend, right, that I wouldn't be able to mention The Walking Dead on this. So okay. I just need to say that
there you've
I
done
mentioned
it.
The Walking Dead.
There you go. You've
there
done
go.
It.
I've done
you've
it. Done I mentioned it. Okay.
There you
I
go.
The best.
That's it.
The snake watches The Walking Dead with Roxy sometimes.
Yeah.
Right.
And Alison, you're a legend. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. We'll take a break. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here. Tara Hammond, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's Slated?
Slated. We are a family-run business creating slate tableware and home accessories. We specialise in personalised gifts and corporate branding as well.
Okay. And you've been watching the news recently with a bit of dismay. Tell us what's worrying you.
It's a little bit of dread, really. It's the unknown with the tariffs for the United States. We fortunately got into the market very early within the business, and we've done a lot of trade shows, put a lot of time into the States. And now if these tariffs come to pass, you know, predominantly because we are a handmade product, so it takes longer and we go in at a premium cost, we feel it's another market now that's just going to vanish.
Right. And how long did it take you to break into the US market? And what would you say was the big moment where you felt you had, you know, established a bit of a foothold there?
Well, we were very lucky. We were a bit green behind the ears. We were doing our very first trade show in Dublin. And we were approached by a big American company and they placed a massive order that we had no idea how we were actually going to fill it. But we did. So we learned an awful lot in a very short space of time.
And you were also, on the commercial channel QVC, so that kind of gave you a regular daytime plug, maybe to a target audience who'd be into the likes of buying gifts and that as well. So tell us about that maybe and how that gave you an extra push in the States.
Well, that was the large order that we had to kind of figure out an awful lot of things in order to fulfil it. Mm. But, I mean, it was a brilliant opportunity because there were so many other Irish brands represented, you know, who'd done this many times. And they were all really kind to us and gave us lots of advice on how to do it. And it was just then, after that, the success of it, we realised, you know, there's a big market we could look at. So we started to do trade shows in New York and then we did them in Washington as well.
So how heavily concentrated on America would you be? Because it's obviously a massive market. And I suppose once you get the foot in the door, you probably have to concentrate quite a bit of effort on pushing in a bit further.
You do. And it is quite difficult in trying to find, you know, target customers and all of that. But like about 30% of the business now is to the States. We'd be 15% to corporate, which is probably, you know, the one that is going to slip away the quickest. And then our stockists tend to be stores that stock just solidly Irish products. So I wonder how they're going to survive the tariffs because, you know, margins are tight. They're shipping from Ireland. And then if there's a 30% premium on products, it's, you know, it's just going to, I don't know, it's going to make everything unsustainable, I think.
Right. So those stores are going to hit you badly. But, I mean, in terms of direct sales, where a store doesn't have to add on, obviously, their own margin on top of what you're getting yourself, do you see any kind of hope that even with the 30%, you might have retained some of your market in direct sales, or are you pretty pessimistic about that?
It all depends. I mean, if they put a limit, you know, sometimes there are limits before taxes apply. So if they keep the limit under $500 or whatever, you know, you'd be fine. But there has been no mention of limits on the tariffs, which is worrying.
Right. So, I mean, how many of you are working in the business, in the family? And give us an idea of how it started out, where the idea for the Slate products came from.
It started out because my husband is a slater by trade. And I got him to make me pieces for my kitchen. And then friends were like, that's a good idea. And it literally just grew from there. And we looked into making products food safe. And then we looked into personalization. And then we've new ranges that we're doing really well in the States, like our landmark collections. We've, you know, got famous Irish landmarks like the Pool Bag, and we carve it into the stone. And we also have our county boards. They, you know, they were very popular in the States as well. So they're, you know, Cavan, Monaghan, wherever, whatever county you like. But you know, the
what you'll cut out the shape of that county, is it in slate and
No. We just like, so the county board would say C is for Cavan, D is for Dublin.
Okay.
And it's a board that you can use in your kitchen. But we carve. We do a deep carve. So it's a beautiful effect, and the landmark are beautiful as well, with the Pool Bag and 40 foot, and we've got Cork, Galway, we've got the cranes up in Belfast, so we've a good selection, and they were going really well for us.
So anyway, the news came, you're dealing with already with it, are you hit by the 10% tariffs that's going at the moment?
Yeah.
And how has that affected things?
It has slowed things considerably. I mean, you can see it. And obviously, as, you know, the consumer loses spending power, they're going to look closer to home. And then, you know, we always naturally have shipping costs. So if an American consumer can find something, I hate to say the A word, but on Amazon where they'll get free shipping or whatever else, they will stay away from the smaller craft-based businesses, unfortunately.
So how have you been pushing yourselves, you know, as an individual product up to now? I mean, I suppose your unique selling point is it's kind of bespoke stuff. It's made in small batches. It's not mass produced.
And everything's made by hand, so and finished by hand. And then, the fact that we cut everything by hand with a knife, and the story, the heritage of the family, over 160 years working with slate. So, I mean, all of that really resonates with people. We understand the products. It's not mass produced. They know there's love and care literally in every box and shredded fingers. So, it makes us very different, really.
But this is the time of the year now at the moment where I think, you know, a lot of people who are maybe looking to buy gifts in advance, spread their costs out before the end of the year. This might be the time where retailers would be putting in orders. Have you noticed any impact on that?
Yeah, there has been a substantial decrease in our repeat orders. We noticed that from last summer, because summer is when our Christmas orders are placed. Because everything's handmade, we need a good lead time to fulfil. So we did notice a decrease last summer, but this summer now it's virtually come to a standstill.
Right.
So in relation to America.
A kind of a nervous 2 weeks coming up until you see what happens on this, this
30%. Yeah, very nervous couple of weeks. And then, we'll have to kind of shift our focus more towards Canada or, continue on with Europe.
Right. And would your main competition be Wales, where, slate quarries, it's kind of synonymous with slate quarries, or... is there a kind of a competitive market in this area, or have you kind of carved out a niche of your own?
I think we've pretty much carved out a niche of our own. We use a high quality slate. It's actually not a Welsh slate. It's purple. I'm going to be really boring now.
No, go for it.
A Welsh slate is purple. We use a black slate. So we use Spanish slate because they actually have the best slate for what we do and how we cut by hand. So, I think we are pretty niche, to be honest, and especially with the carving. Because other people just, laser engrave, which isn't nearly as nice.
Okay. And it's just just you, the family members doing it, or had you plans to take on other people?
It's myself, my husband. My son also cuts, and my daughter is very good now at helping fulfill orders as well. So it's just all of us, and we outsource anything else we need. And it's kept us going since 2010 anyway.
Okay, well, there it is, put on the radar. So the very best of luck with it. I hope there's some improvement and that it doesn't come to pass. But the best of luck to you looking for the new markets and that in the meantime. Tara Hammond there. The whole issue of tariffs is put on the radar today. You might have heard various government ministers out over the last while saying the uncertain economic horizon means that one-off cost of living measures are not going to be looked at in the budget this year. Declan Alcock, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much. Do you want to give us give us an idea of your own kind of day-to-day shopping experience?
I'm here on my own, like a lot of people, and as I said, it costs the same to heat a house with one person in it as it does with four or five people in it. You know, little things that we might just take for granted. But I've noticed, I go into, say, to the supermarket and I just be buying a few things. I'm not someone that buys in bulk or a big trolley load of things because I'm on my own here. But, and I don't like getting too much either because, you know, we just don't like to waste and have to throw things out. But I've noticed that little few little extra little things that are kind of constantly just that little extra. During the week there now, I bought a box of cereal. And there isn't, I'm sorry now, I didn't keep the last box I had of it. But there is no way is it the same size at the previous box.
The old shrinkflation, less in it than there was before.
I mean, there is. I mean, and it was up as well on the price, but there is no way is that box of cereal the same as the box of cereal I got a few months ago.
Right. Do you like chocolate by any chance?
No. This is.
Have you noticed that either my hands are getting bigger or the chocolate bars are getting smaller?
I have a terrible sweet tooth. It's a bad habit, but I've definitely noticed. Now, in fairness, I do like to have the few treats because when people call, you make tea or whatever you want to do and coffee, and you like to have your chocolates. And I've definitely noticed. But what I'm just saying is, like, over the last number of months, I go in, say, where I go, it's handy just to pull in the car and go in and get me a few things. And I just literally run around. I throw the things in a basket and I'd be gone. But now I notice I'm just that little bit more observant. I'm just checking the few little things. Like, I've noticed something there now, even during the week, that I didn't go for. I went for a totally different brand. But I'm just, you know, and
go on, give us an example without telling us the brand.
There was a tin of something, okay? Mm-hmm. And usually I just might have went, I just grabbed it. But the other day I was there and I noticed the price. Now, it's definitely, from the last time I got it, it's definitely gone, maybe not a euro more, but it's definitely not far away from an extra. And it struck me when I saw the price, you see, that it definitely is. Now maybe someone like me, I'm not observing it as much as I should, but I went for the other brand, and what I noticed on the shelf, maybe the staff had just stocked the shelves, but I noticed that brand that I was normally going to take was well stocked, but the other brand that I took for, I could see that it was little of it. Now, whether it's just that, like me, other people went for the other brand, if you follow the point I'm trying to make to you. But as I said, I'm just going to be a little bit more observant, and I have started to be a little bit more observant. Instead of just running in, getting me things, putting them into the basket and running out, paying it, tapping it, and not thinking twice about it. But I have noticed lately, I've just been double checking with things, and I do notice, like, even as you said, I just said the example there of the cereal, and you'd notice it with the bars of chocolate and the chocolate biscuits and things like that. And I do believe there's less in it. And it's like, I heard someone there recently talking about, I don't know what, he was some politician in the Dáil talking about a constituency of his that was talking about a thing that we take for granted. You go in, you buy a packet of rashers, throw them in your bag and you're gone. But he noticed the price of the rashers had went up. But he definitely noticed when he went home that instead of, say, five rashers, there was only four rashers in the packet.
And come here, you were telling the team you're fond of a sandwich, and you noticed it kind of in the sandwich ingredients. That was one of the things you noticed.
That was the thing I noticed. Yeah, even, you know, like maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe it's just because I'm thinking, but I just think packets are just gone that little. There's less in things, and there's just that little extra. Like, for example, if I was going in now, say, into the supermarket, and I was just getting a couple of things on a regular basis, now just a couple of things, and I'd say a few things, and I'd put, maybe if I wasn't tapping my card, and I might put, say, a tenner into it, and you might have got, I would have waited for the few little bits of change to pop out. But I noticed there recently, I put a tenner in it, and it looked for another 1.20. You know, so instead of actually getting change, I've noticed I've been putting in that little extra. Now, most of the time, I just tap my card, so that's why I haven't been as observant as I said before. But now I'm just that little bit more watching things, and I did notice the few little things, like I said, the cereal, the things, for example, the sandwich spread and little things like that I'd noticed, that I'd use, you know, even a packet of cheese, things like that. So yeah. I just feel, I don't know, but I just don't know what we're going to do about it, because, like, as I said, you know, it costs the same to heat a house with one person in it as it does with four or five people. I wonder, are we heading for a winter of discontent? I just listened to Jack Chambers there, the Minister of Finance, on the 1 o'clock news, and about assistance for people, and it's obviously they've been flagging this now for quite a number of months now. There isn't going to be anything coming down the road for people, any type of assistance, and are things going to be, you know, as energy bills going to go up, or things going to go up, or people going to be just cutting back on things, you know. And you'd need to watch too as well if you're driving in the car, like, okay, I'm using petrol, but fine, I'd have a little bit more observant of it, you know. It might be 172 a litre. A place further down, it could be 169. You know, it's okay going in and putting, say, 40 or 50 euro into the car. You know, you might be spending 40 or 50 euro in different garages, but you might be getting more or less, more. You might be getting more in a place or less in a place for the same amount. Mm. And little things that people, you know, you mightn't look at that type of thing. Prices, we might just pull in and you're going into a place and you don't think of the price. You think you're spending 50 euro, but if you look at the price, you'll see that it could be 169 a litre somewhere, and it could be 171 or 172 a litre somewhere else. But it's just those little things that I think if everybody now, we're just going to have to be that little bit more observant and things. And it is, people are feeling it. I mean, you know, someone telling me, like, spending on the family a couple of hundred euro maybe a week on a trolley of groceries, and they're noticed now without anything different, that's pushing up near now to the 300 euro a week.
That's
so,
for sure.
You know,
yeah,
that's you're talking about an extra 400 euro a month out of a family, you know, and the energy bills and things like that. So it's all that little thing that we just, you know, so I don't know what we're heading for. I don't know where it's going to go. I've just listened to Jack Chambers there on the 1 o'clock news.
Yeah, the public expenditure minister. Would you have a view on whether or not he was talking about how there won't be kind of blanket one-off measures, that there'd be targeted measures. Yeah. And any idea where they should go?
Well, I mean, the things that energy bills and things, maybe before you go outside the door, maybe it'd be a help, you know. But I don't think the way they're talking about this now, and I mean, you go back months now and listening to government speaking, they've been throwing this out now for quite a while for people to be ready for it. I don't think there's anything going to happen in the autumn budget. I just think there's going to be any help for anybody, and that's just because it's been out. They're all well versed. I mean, you listen to any government minister, or Taoiseach or Tarnish or anybody, they're all being very, very well briefed and well versed on what they're saying, and it's the same thing coming out. Like, this has been well flagged that there isn't, I don't see anything, any assistance coming down the road.
All right, well, that's it. According to them, there'll be targeted measures, and we don't know what they are yet, but I think the junior retail minister, Alan Dillon, was saying there's rising cost of groceries. They're aware of its impact on consumers, and they say that they intend to provide the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission with new and additional powers to impose administrative financial sanctions in respect of breaches. But it's not quite clear from that what they mean by that. Anyway, we'll take a break. We'll be back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Now, what you're going to hear next, it may have also happened to you. If it did, we want to hear from you. 087 484 8888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 for your text. Liveline at rte.ie for your emails. Mary Frances Fahy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Not too bad now, thanks. How are you keeping?
Well, I'm perfect now at this stage, thankfully.
Okay. Will you tell us what happened?
I was in Mallorca on a hill walking holiday in a small port area called Port Saleh, a quiet location, and I was out on a hill walking trail, walking back from the village of Dea back to Port Saleh, and I had a handbag in my rucksack where I had a substantial sum of money, my work phone, keys, my car key, cards, etc. And someone came up behind me on the trail, opened my rucksack, and stole my handbag without me even realising that somebody had come up behind me. Incredibly skillful theft.
Just silently crept up behind you and was rifling through your bag. Were you on your own?
No, I had a friend of mine was with me, and they must have watched us carefully, because at various points along the walk, she would have been behind me, and at other times she would have been in front of me walking along the trail. So at a point when she was in front of me, they came up behind me and carried out the robbery.
And was it a crowded path? Were there a lot of people on it, or were you...
Yeah, it was quite busy. There would have been a lot of people right on the path, yeah, definitely.
But no sense of a kind of a tug or anything distracting on the rucksack as they were going through it?
Absolutely not. And the first thing that I realised was that my rucksack was lighter than it had been. I said to myself, I must have drank all my water. It's unusual, but I must have... Water is heavy. But in fact, the phone that I had in the rucksack was quite heavy, and I could just feel it, that my pack was lighter. That's the only indication, you know, that I had that something was amiss, I suppose, that something had occurred.
And how long do you think it had been missing by the time you noticed it?
Oh, only about 5 or 10 minutes, because I remember noticing my rucksack was light. And then the next thing I saw is my jacket that was in my bag falling onto the ground. And I looked back and I noticed that my bag was open. At first I thought I'd forgotten to fasten my rucksack properly, but no, that I realised, no, it would, you know, that definitely wasn't the case, no.
Right, and you knew then somebody had robbed you. This wasn't a mistake on your part. Nobody behind you on the path saw anything or seemed to indicate to you that they had seen anyone interfering with your rucksack?
No, nobody had noticed anything.
Right.
I couldn't believe it. Myself and my friend couldn't believe it, to be honest.
Like, you are an experienced traveller, you'd be expecting this or more wary of this maybe in a big city.
Oh, absolutely. I've been in Naples, for example, which would be one of the cities where crime is and theft of that nature is quite high. And I would be very careful, you know, I would have things like around my waist to carry money, and I'd be watchful, very, very careful, especially on that trip train out to Pompeii and all. And I've been in Barcelona as well, which would be another place that is kind of famous for, you know, but I would have thought you'd be more likely to be robbed in Dublin than you would be in a small little place like Port Salut. There you go. And especially out hill walking, you know, I've been on loads of hill walking holidays, nothing like that. I'd never be suspecting anything like that.
So the bag that was taken out of your bag, this is, I suppose, the one with the most important personal effects that you'd want to keep close to yourself. What was in it? Just you had money and you had keys and cards.
My work phone, which proved crucial in being able to locate the bag, you know, in being able to locate it. Cards, my car keys, my house keys, and my boarding pass, actually, as it happens.
So did you went to the local police, did you?
Well, I did, yes. But before that, I actually phoned the phone that was in my bag, and an English person living in Port Salut actually heard the phone ringing, and I managed to recover a number of items that were in the bag, to include my car and house keys and the phone, and that was great, and the cards as well. So okay. After that, I went to the police and I made a police report, which is essential if you want to make a claim on your travel insurance.
And did that save you cancelling the cards, or did you cancel all of those just to be...
No, I didn't cancel the cards. I checked the cards, you know, to make sure that there was no unusual activity on them. And no, and the local police actually told me that these were professional robbers or whatever, and that they had no interest at all in anything other than cash.
Just cash.
Yeah.
So anyway, an English person answered the phone on the other end. What, it was just discarded in a ditch or near a bin or something, was it?
Thrown beside these tram lines that weren't very far from my hotel where I was staying, actually. Thrown beside tram lines. And he actually, fair play to me, actually brought the bag back to my hotel for me. So I was very lucky there.
And how far was the walk you were on from your hotel? That, it's kind of unusual, is it, that the bag ended up turning up near to where you were staying?
Well, it would have been stolen from me quite a short distance before I came off the actual hill walking trail onto the road, and the police were telling me that the thieves are obviously watching people coming off the trail, coming onto the road, and then they pounce, I suppose.
Right. How did you feel about it? Were you just concerned to get the stuff back, or did you get a bit of a land?
Oh, I got a shock, a great shock. I mean, I didn't like the idea that I was being watched. But obviously somebody had been watching me for some considerable period of time, and yeah, I just didn't like that feeling, and kind of, well, I mean, it did put a bit, that day, it definitely did put a damper on that day, that, you know, I just didn't think that would happen when you're out hill walking.
For sure. And the fact that not only had somebody been watching you, but they'd actually, somebody, they or somebody else had crept up behind you and looted your rucksack.
Yeah. And the bag wasn't on the top of the rucksack. They had to take out my sweatshirt and off the top before they'd, you know, it wasn't just right at the top either. So they rifled through my rucksack. Imagine without me even sensing that somebody was that close to me.
On one level, you must have been nearly marvelling at it.
I was, actually, yeah. I really thought, how did they do that? And how did they select me? Say, my friend would have had no money with her, or maybe 20 euro or something, but that I did, actually. And how did they select me? I wonder, were they watching me when I went for a cup of coffee, an hour and a half further back on the track or something?
Somebody
ring them.
You'd stopped in at a cafe or something, had you?
A finca, yeah, and a lovely finca. About an hour and a half, but it was an hour and a half. At least from the finca to where the robbery took place.
What's a finca?
A kind of a posh sort of old building that they have in Mallorca, where you can, it's like a little hotel or that, where you can, a coffee shop, stone building with beautiful flowers and all that, where you can stop for a cup of coffee.
Right. It would be slightly more high end than your average cafe. So you think that might be where you were spotted, or that might be the building they had been watching?
Yes, I wondered about that, and whether they would have telephoned somebody perhaps further ahead and given a description of me, maybe, and said, we saw this lady, you know, maybe taking out a bag or something, you know.
So you recovered all of the hard stuff, not the cash out of it.
Yeah.
But you did go about trying to get the cash back because you had travel insurance. So for anybody else who...
Thankfully I did, yeah.
Yeah, for anyone else who, you know, is trying to avoid something like this happening, if you were doing it all over again and to try and avoid this, and if you were giving people advice on claiming it back, give us a few hard and fast rules as you see it now.
Well, the first thing I'd have done anyway is to read, find out what kind of a travel insurance policy I had. I mean, being a solicitor, I didn't even read the policy documents, and I should have done that, obviously. And there's different categories of travel insurance. Sometimes it's worth spending an extra 20 or 30 euros to get a better category of. So I had a multi-trip travel insurance policy, but it turned out to be great, actually. But that was just lucky, you know, that I didn't even look and see. That's the first thing I would do, is check and get some sort of a travel insurance policy that suits you and decide whether or not to want one with an excess or no excess. And it might be worth, again, paying a few quid for the extra, so you won't have one with an excess. And then I'd make sure that I'd an app. Finding my phone, having a phone, locating the phone was crucial, being able to ring the phone and my phone being located. So there are apps you can put on your phone, Find My Phone or whatever, where you can track your phone and find it. And that would be a very helpful thing to do. And there's also sensors and things you can put on your keys, you know, that would assist you in finding them as well. So that would be very important.
And you'd mentioned you'd printed out your boarding card. Anything else like that, you know, that... So did you have...
Oh, yeah, I'd print out a physical copy of my board. And I'd also photocopy the front and back of the cards. My cards could have been stolen, they weren't in this instance. But I'd photocopy the front and back of them so that you'd have the numbers handy. And also, I'd print off my travel insurance documents too, so you'd have the number of the travel... Just to set your mind at ease, you could ring the travel insurance company and alert them that something had happened.
Right.
All of that, you know.
And... Any luck with getting any of the cash back? Was that covered on your travel insurance?
Yes, a certain amount of it was covered. Quite a good bit of it was covered in my travel insurance, actually. I couldn't believe it. But you have to show evidence. Luckily, I had withdrawn it from the bank machine before I left, so I had to show evidence that I'd done that, and I did. So that was useful as well.
So overall, a bit of a shock, but lesson learned at this stage.
Lesson learned. I was so lucky. There was other people in the police station when I was there, quite a queue of people, actually, where they had... their travel documents stolen, they, you know, weren't able to leave the country, you know, they didn't get, their cards were lost, they had no money, not a penny, not a cent, because they had no cards or anything, and they were so upset, and I, in comparison with these people, I was just so lucky.
All right, Mary Frances Fahey, thanks very much for that. Thanks for sharing that with us. I hope that's a help to anybody else out there who's preparing to go. We'll take a break, back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715
The first Irish cyclist in nearly 40 years to get the yellow jersey in the Tour de France is Ben Healy. For people who maybe don't follow cycling, they mightn't have heard of him, but some people have been monitoring his progress and are certainly well into the cycling, including the Tour de France. Claire Fagan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. You're calling us from where?
Near Toulouse, in the south of France. In Holly Bops, the camper van.
Very good. And you're over there. You're to coincide with the Tour de France, is it?
Yeah. We were here on holidays, but it was an added bonus that we got to see a stage, or we're going to get to see a stage on the tour on Saturday, hopefully.
Right. And are you a cycling family?
We are, Colm, from a very young age. We followed the tour in the early 90s when Stephen Roach and Sean Kelly were part of the tour. We were there supporting them with the flags out.
So it's in the family, is it?
My dad, my dad and my brother and all his family, we call them the six pack. They are avid cyclists. My dad, who's nearly, well, actually, he'll be hitting his 80th year, Jim, he is part of the Lakeside Wheelers in Mullingar, and he's still out on the bike nearly every day. keeps them sane.
You're not the only member of the family in France. Your aforementioned brother,
no.
The leader of the six-pack, he's yeah. there too.
Yes, he is. Kevin and all his gang are there. They got to see a stage there a couple of days ago, stage 9. So we do follow it a good bit.
And have you been following Ben Healy, or were you aware of him before the Tour de France? And what kind of, you know, what kind of stuff are you following of his progress over there?
Yeah, we knew that he was part of the tour when we started from Dublin there a couple of weeks ago, and we were just hopeful that he'd stay on in the tour. We know that Eddie Dunbar unfortunately had to call out of it, but. Healy is doing absolutely fantastic, like, for such a young rider. Like, we saw at the start that he was kind of ranking top 10 in the young rider section of it, but to get a yellow jersey in the last stage was just out of this world.
And I was listening to Morning Ireland earlier, and, you know, he's not a big guy. This isn't big long legs driving a bicycle up a hill. He's only about, I think, 5'6", the guest there was saying, and his size kind of stands to him. People can't get in behind him and into his slipstream.
And he's what's called, he's a monster on the mountains, I think is what some people call him, that he just chews mountains up. So we're actually going, the stage that we're going to is in the Pyrenees, and we hope to see him out front.
All right, so you're basing your holiday around him. Okay, we have Neil De La Haye. You know him, do you?
Hi, yeah, how's it going? Sorry, I'm the head coach with the Cycling Federation. So, yeah, worked with Ben for the last number of years.
Very good. And so this doesn't really come, I mean, you know, a yellow jersey in the Tour de France is obviously probably a very pleasant surprise to him on one level. But in terms of his progress in cycling, you're not as shocked as people maybe who are only becoming aware of him this year.
No, absolutely not. Like, he's obviously come into the public eye now in a huge way, but it's been a real steady and consistent progression for him over a number of years, from right when he was junior and right through. He's been tipping away annually and putting in some really, really big results and getting better each year. It's a hugely inspirational performance to see what he's done. I mean, the stage win in itself was massive. I think everyone was really buzzing after that. And I think once he got the realization yesterday that the opportunity for the yellow jersey was there, he just went for it and delivered a super strong ride to pull that off.
But just, I mean, it is massive, as you say, but for people who may not really realise how massive it is, spell it out, because, you know, as I said at the outset there, the first Irish cyclist since 1987 to be where he is today. Give us an idea of how big a deal that is for Irish cycling.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, everybody knows Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach in terms of being household names. Even if you weren't into cycling, you would have recognised what they did and what they brought to the country in terms of recognition as high-level sports people. Ben has now catapulted himself up into that same level for sure. I mean, the Tour de France itself, you know, as an event on the ground, gets in the region of 12 million spectators when it's rolling out over the 3 weeks in France. But globally, there's literally hundreds of millions, if not billions, with eyes on it. So it's going to be a whole new level of awareness of everybody of who Ben is. But like I said, it's not a flash in the pan result. He's really worked super hard for this. He's built it up over the last few years. I mean, even last year in Paris, he was 10th in the road race there and very, very close to a medal. He was 7th in the World Championships and the same situation. He's an aggressive rider. He gets up the road ahead of the race. So it's an exciting style that he has. He has a very aggressive mentality. He wants to lead the race from the front. He's make sure he's on the front foot. And if he has a plan in his mind, he's really well able to execute that
right
and go for it when the opportunity opens up.
And where he is in his career at the moment, I mean, he didn't try and jump the gun into maybe areas where, you know, he didn't try and get ahead of himself. He was happy to stay at under 23 and do the challenge. I think even he said before that when he was a young lad, his dad maybe held him back from going too far too quickly. And he thinks this has stood to him.
I think so, yeah. I mean, he started off in mountain biking, so he came in with a high level of skill, and that was a real attribute that he still carries forward today. But he was happy to operate in the under 23 ranks for a couple of years to learn his craft. And I think that was been a big part of why he's progressed as he has. He was keen to learn the sport, understand how to win, figure out the tactics, and he really is a master tactician now. We had him as an under 23, as a junior, where he had success. I mean, he won stages in the Baby Giro, which is the under 23 version of the Giro d'Italia. He also won a stage in the Tour de l'Avenir, which is the under 23 Tour de France. So the talent was always there. The mentality to win has really evolved over the last number of years, and it's just fantastic to see it now, and absolutely up to the same level as our Kellys and Roaches.
And can you give us a bit of an idea, you know, of his background, how he came to be cycling from Ireland, and just, you know, what kind of a person he is?
Yeah, well, the Irish connection is all on his dad's side. So he is Irish. He's always had the passport. He started riding and declared for Ireland around 2016, and immediately for us it was racing at a junior. So he's really been around for the whole period of his development into the pro ranks. He's very relaxed kind of a guy off the bike. I think it's a skill set pro riders need, is to be able to moderate the stress levels and amp things down when they have to. And there's so much energy and stress in the racing environment, and off the bike he knows certainly how to keep himself in a calm state and just focus on what he needs to when he has to. So he's very easy to work with. He's very methodical. He knows what he's doing. He certainly has a keen eye for detail. He loves dialing into the equipment particulars that can make you fast, the marginal gains, as they say, from the speed suits to the helmets to his position on the bike. And there's nothing there that he won't have explored with his team or that he hasn't explored with us. And all those little things really add up. And when he gets the opportunity to deliver what he's capable of doing, I think he gets the extra speed from making sure there's no stone left unturned.
Right. You mentioned there, you know, staying stressed and being fairly horizontal in his attitude off the bike. How much of an enemy is nervous energy to people in cycling, you know, the mental game?
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, look, there's a baseline physiology and physical capacity you have to access that level of pro cycling. So, you know, everyone understands that how much training is needed. You might need a little bit of genetic help, I suppose, with your talents physiologically. But the mental component is absolutely huge. Like 200 riders packed like sardines, traveling around the roads, trying to dodge road furniture, coming down hills at 80 kilometers an hour. All this kind of stuff is super stressful. And to be able to deal with that in the moment, stay upright, and also have the mental acuity and clarity to make the right decisions at the right times, it's a massive, massive skill in itself. And I think without that, there's no way he'd be achieving what he's doing now. And I feel even from us as a federation, we put a lot of focus on pathway activity, where we're trying to, you know, encourage young riders to think about those off-the-bike aspects that can actually help them go faster when they get the chance to compete. And it's a big body of work, but it can give you such a competitive edge when you get that right.
All right. Just stay with us there, Neil, because Kevin Jennings, you're glued to the telly, are you?
I'm away from it just now today. It's a rest day. But, it was some excitement yesterday, Cullum. Yeah. And fabulous to listen to Neil there. What a catch. And what a super story about, especially about how he worked his way up to the ranks rather than being accelerated through his development by his parents, which you see in a lot of sports. But my bike, I'm only on the bike now going to the shops or something with the kids, or we might do the odd trip on the Greenway. My days have been on a fast bike are long gone.
Right. Are you old enough to remember, you know, the Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach years and Paul Kimmage and all the Irish cyclists from that
remember
era?
Remember some of that, but even when my son was yesterday, they wanted to watch something else on the telly, and we got really into this, and they remembered the Sam Bennett stuff during COVID a few years ago when he won the green jersey and the excitement at it. Now, we don't have the Tour de France on in our house. You know, we're not, I'd follow the Giros and things like that, but only reading about them. But the Tour de France is just always on in the background. It's just so good to watch, and to see an Irish person winning that, it's unbelievable.
And for, you know, I mean, for you, who remembers, you know, the Roach Kelly era, talking to your kids and trying to impart to them what a big deal this is, as a cycling fan, how gratifying is it to have somebody that they're, you know, your kids can see and visualise and kind of attach their dreams and ambitions to as a role model?
Yeah, no, it brings it back because everything is local like that. You know, that's why the GA and things are brilliant, that you have a neighbour a few doors up, you know, and they're playing county or something like that, and the ripple effect that that has. And the cyclers, I mean, Ben, I guess I can't say I've seen him around on the streets here, but, you know, he's been racing in Ireland, like Neil said, since 2016. And to see that this is something achievable, even though you're kind of in two minds with your kids, you know, you'd love them to feel the sensation of the of cycling fast and the wind in your hair and all that sort of thing. But then again, it's a kind of dangerous activity, flying down a hill or something. So it's great that they can be trained up into these things. But to see something like this is achievable is incredible for them because it makes it real. And again, the Sam Bennett story, you know, with him being so close, I suppose. And, you know, people who go around cycling here in Galway, where I am, Sean Roach is still often out cycling around the roads here. And people often have a selfie and things like that. I haven't been out on the bike for a few years, like just with the young kids and things, but I'm hoping someday I'll get out and get the selfie with them, or even if the kids get a selfie with them.
And what about, when did Ben Healy first come on your radar? I mean, you know, you're aware he's been around since 2016, but when would you say you noticed him?
Oh, big time yesterday.
Right, okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd have seen the name, but no more than Eddie Dunbar, you know, these are top athletes or whatever. But, you know, it's only, well, when he won the stage a few days ago, I suppose. But, you know, you don't expect these things from an Irish rider. I'm sorry, I mean, to Neil and those, I mean, but it, you know, I really don't expect Irish riders to achieve at these levels. And I suppose nobody really expects Ben to win the race. I just thought it was so good, the tactics that he switched from having a chance to win in the stage yesterday to saying, oh, the yellow jersey's on, I'll go for that. And what an achievement it is. It's fabulous. I mean, it has everybody buzzing about it.
Right. You know, Frank Ryan, you're glued to it as well. You were watching it on TGA Car. What was the excitement like as you kind of began to believe this was a realistic prospect, a stage win?
I think, to be honest, Colin, it was just like I was watching it there and I was kind of going, is this really happening? Because you forget that it's so long ago since the Roach Kelly era, you know, nearly 40 years, that we had a chance of a yellow jersey. And like, it was still down, you know, it was all dependent on, you know, despite all the work they put in, he mightn't have made it. You know, he finished third yesterday, but if the people behind had, you know, there would be a bit more activity. All that gap that he has now, the 29 seconds, could have been just whittled away. But it was just one of those moments that it only kind of starts to sink in later on that this is the same thing that happened. You know, and I suppose it's something that's not going to happen, will probably never happen again in my lifetime, but it's something we should savour now, because I can remember the Roach Kelly era. Oh my God, it was just such excitement. I was racing at the time and you'd have kids coming up asking for your autograph. I mean, I was a nobody, you know. Right. And it was just amazing, the buzz that was there at that time. And like now, I think the difference is that cycling is appealing to, we have got really good male cyclists, but we also have really strong female cyclists. So it's appealing across, as your previous commentator said, like that, you know, I mean, his family, now it's not just a male-only sport anymore. This is for everybody. And I think this is going to have a real impact on cycling in Ireland and, you know, the enthusiasm levels that we need, this kind of injection of enthusiasm.
All right. So take us back now to you watching this. I mean, what state were you in? Were you up out of the seat cheering them on?
I mean, the poor neighbours are probably about to call the emergency services because I was there shouting at the screen, you know. And I mean, it's just, you know, because it's not happening like in, it's not just somebody running up towards the goal and it's all over in 10 or 15 seconds. You're there like I'm on the edge of your seat, kind of urging him on. And it's like that. And it was just, you know, Ben was putting in all the work and I could see all the other riders just letting him off. And I was kind of shouting. I was going, oh my God. Getting so angry at them, like, because they were just relying on Ben's efforts all the time.
Right. I mean, as you say, it's not in and out quick thing. You're talking about a stage of 165 kilometres. I mean, it's huge distances.
And he does everything that's, you know, the managers, team managers would tell him not to do. You know, conserve your energy, wait until the decisive moment. I know Ben does it after about 20 kilometres out the road. And then he's out there. Like, that's it. If you get caught, you know, you're finished. You're not going to be able to do any performance that day. So Ben does everything. I would say the team managers, but it was amazing yesterday on TG Car, like they were giving a little insight into what the team managers were saying to their riders. And they all mentioned Ben Healy. And you just knew like that they all felt Ben was the man. This was his day. And of course, it was proved right, wasn't it? You know, there he is, like in, what is it, the Ganzi Vui, as they'd say in TG Car, the Ganzi Bon. You know, he has the white jersey now for the best under 25 rider. And I mean, that could be the jersey that he may end up with.
Right. I think everybody is pulling on the Gansey gloss and cheering him on as they're watching. Do you watch, I mean, are you an avid cycling fan or would you normally just watch the Tour de France?
No, I'd be watching it. And unfortunately, you know, cycling has gone behind a kind of quite a hefty paywall.
Right. So it used to be on Eurosport, wasn't it? People could watch quite a bit of it on that, but before that went, yeah.
And that was like so widely available. And the amount of people that would come up to me in the street and said, I know you're into cycling, but I've been watching the Tour de France or the Giro, you know, Tour of Spain. And I mean, it's just a shame, like when, but that's, I suppose, the nature of sport. But thanks be to God for TG Car.
Right.
You know, that it's giving us that outlet there. And I mean, I know that it's finishing up on ITV4 as well. So hopefully TG Car will retain the rights to it.
Yeah, Clealish and Ruhiacht. Martin Fitzgerald, you were also watching it, were you?
Yeah, I was watching it there, basically stage six. And then I kind of more or less, I thought it couldn't get any better than that. Because even though, like, I was kind of watching it here on my own, basically. Yeah, I was kind of willing him on because it's kind of a slow burn, kind of with stage itself. But like, even though like on stage six when he attacked, like the group he was in, like they weren't slouches in the group. Like you had Eddie Dunbar, like, which is another Irish guy who was two stage winner of the Tour of Spain last year. Then you had Simon Yates, who was like winner of the Giro d'Italia this year. Then you had Van der Poel, like, who was an ex-world champion and three times Paris-Roubaix. So, and then you'd also a national champion from America. So the guys he was in the group with, they weren't slouches. Like, he was able to just go and he just went, and that was it. He put his head down and went for it. But it seems to me that it's very tactical what he'd done, and he had it all clued in, like, basically what he'd done. But when he crashed then the next day, so literally he was well up. He was in the top 10, like, after stage six. But then, like, when he crashed, there was a bad crash then, I think, on stage the next day, and he lost some time. And I thought, like, no, there's no hope again in the yellow jersey then after that then. But then the next day then, like, obviously the team had a plan, like, and they were very calculated. So literally he went for it. But, yeah, like, I couldn't believe it. Like, this is actually happening, you know?
Right. It seems that he worked well with his team as well, that tactically, you know, the number of people who helped him along as well was part of the strategy.
Yeah, you don't get to that stage, like, you know, without having a team plan. Like, it's not just kind of, look, I'm feeling good today, I'm going to go. There's certain rules and kind of tactics that are particularly employed. And also, as well, the stage kind of suits his profile as well, because if you look at his MO, anything that goes over, like, 200 kilometres, like, and it's a hard day, like, it's just built for him, you know. So, like, you kind of felt like that the course and the terrain kind of laid it in his hands. But, like, you know, knowing the path and walking the path are two different sort of things, because right. Even in a 200-kilometre, over 200-kilometre cycle race, anything can happen, like, anything can happen, you know.
Okay. There's a piece, actually, online by the freelance cycling writer and journalist Ger Cromwell, and in terms of the biographical detail, it's Ben's father Brian is the youngest and only one of three siblings to be born in England, apparently, after his Waterford and Cork born parents moved to London in the 60s in search of employment. Love took Brian to Birmingham, where his son Ben was born and reared. Michael O'Callaghan, you've met him, have you?
Yes, I have. I've met Ben, and I have actually met Sam as well. And that's the reason why I'm ringing, because we were in Powell, both my wife and I and our two pets. We were down to the stage 13 or 14 last year. And so it was, we went down roughly 15 kilometres before the finish line in Powell, because we had our own Irish corner there and the Irish flags were flying by us, which was beautiful. And the following day then we went in to Powell to meet him. And just the reason I'm ringing is that young man, Ben, had roughly about 15 minutes to go before the start line. And I asked him, would he mind coming over to meet my wife, because she was under the trees with our two retrievers. And we had him in the shade there. And he gave us of his time, and we spoke to him, and I couldn't get over how generous he was with his time with us. And he thanked us for following him, and we had the tricolour with us, and a great experience to meet him. I also met him in Scotland when he was cycling for Ireland in the international cycling, the World Tour.
All right, so you follow cycling. This is, do you base your holidays around cycling races?
You know, it's a good question. We were in France for about 6 weeks that week, and we went down there especially to meet him. Do I base my holidays? No, but I would love to, because we have a motorhome, and I would love to do that, but I haven't. It takes two to make a decision like that.
Right.
You know, I'm a cyclist up here in Tralee, so I know how hard it is for cyclists to get that to that standard.
Okay, well, I might go kind of quickly around you and maybe get your best guess as to where it might go from here, because in that piece from Ger Cromwell yesterday, he was pointing out that a number of other winners of the stage, the Tour de l'Avenir that he won, have gone on to win the Tour as well. So, Michael, what chance would you give him to finish at least in a kind of a top 10 position, or maybe even the podium?
I was actually hoping that he would finish in within the top 10. I was really hoping. And when I saw that on the news last night, it was actually my wife that told me that he was in yellow, and I just... I couldn't get over it. I just right. could not get over it. And I was so happy for that young man. Absolutely.
Okay. Kevin Jennings, in a word, how far?
Oh, God, dreaming of third on the podium. Okay. But top 10 would be great.
Okay. All right. We